Okay, well, thanks for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work we've been doing in the Sierra Foothill region of California for the last 3 years and how that may or may not relate to the applicability of digital soil mapping techniques in similar landscapes. So throughout this talk, I'm going to use some terminology, digital proxies for landscape processes or surface derivatives or DEM derivatives. And really what I'm talking about are a couple main commonly generated surfaces from elevation models. First, something along the lines of the compound topographic index. This is an index of kind of watershed scale connectivity and flow accumulation. It's been used for the last 20, 30 years. It doesn't always work well, but it's something that's been commonly used. I'm also going to be talking about indices of local convergence or divergence, so surface curvatures. This is something we can relate to in terms of describing hill slope shape and processes. And then a quantitative description of microclimate in the form of modeled solar radiation. It turns out that the geometry of the sun and the earth is fairly well defined, and if you incorporate local shading, you can generate fairly useful indices of microclimate. And again, these surfaces ultimately depend on the quality of the elevation model and the scale at which you're calculating them. So some things to keep in mind. Again, I want to make a slight distinction here between prediction versus inference in the context of soil landscape modeling. A lot of focus has been put on prediction. So predictive soil mapping is a term you hear a lot, where the emphasis is really on the final product. And sometimes that leads to black box approaches where they might be parameterized or optimized for their predictive capacity, but not necessarily optimized for their ability to generalize across landscapes or different lithologies. But of course, prediction has its place. These products have a great value to the users and to current and new users of soils data. So this prediction's important, but boy, it'd be great if we could get a little bit farther to what I'm in this case calling inference, where we can try and directly interpret the components of these models or the model terms as a way of encapsulating and preserving field-derived knowledge. So taking what people do out in the field and building that into a statistical model that ideally will generalize to a wide range in conditions, assuming some kind of stratification, and ultimately support quantitative description of pedogenic processes. So try and keep both sides of this coin in mind as I go through these. Obviously, we're a little bit more focusing on prediction here, but inference is where we want to be, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. So quick motivation. A lot of people ask, why would you bother with the Sierra Foothill region? It's kind of sparsely populated. Well, there's a couple reasons. There are growing population centers and quite a bit of land use conversion, particularly to converting rangeland to viticulture and things like that. Clearly, there's some pretty important soil property limitations in regards to septic system, slope failure, and obviously water quality in these regions. And on top of that, two-thirds of the surface water supply for California ultimately passes through this region. So clearly, we detailed inventories of the soil resources and interpretations derived from the soil information are very important here. In addition, the Sierra Foothill region is an ideal setting for evaluating digital soil mapping technologies. There's a wide range in lithologies. You find repeating landscape units of moderate to intense relief, which really lends itself to topographic modeling of soil properties. And we're fortunate there's a couple active soil surveys going on right now. So this is a fine place and time to really explore soil landscape relationships in the Sierra Foothill region. And on top of that, this region has been historically very coarsely mapped. So if you go along from the San Joaquin Valley up into the foothills here, you can see a pretty drastic change in map unit size. Very quickly, a couple questions that we wanted to address. These digital proxies for soil forming factors, these landscape or surface derivatives from elevation models, do these actually predict the differences in soil microclimate that we think they are, that the hill slope model suggests? And boy, yeah, we think that they should. They seem to model what we're seeing out there, and possibly more so in steeper terrain. Next to these digital proxies for soil forming factors actually predict differences in measured soil properties. And if the hill slope model is it in any way correct, we would think that yes, they would, and possibly more so where the terrain is more intense. And then a different kind of question: how important is the watershed scale variability in lithology? How important is that with respect to soil properties? And we think in these cases that the landscape indices may be more important than small scale variability in lithology. So we're using fairly standard methods of digging pits, describing them, sampling by genetic horizon. We also have installed soil moisture and temperature sensors at multiple depths in these profiles as a way to really understand, are these digital indices telling us what we think they're telling us about soil moisture and temperature? Standard methods for measuring particle size distribution, total carbon, pH, CEC, exchangeable cations, fairly typical selective dissolution for iron and manganese, looking at their crystallinity. Colorimetric analysis, and we were fortunate enough to borrow from Thermo Fisher a portable X-ray fluorescence meter, which allows us to key into watershed scale variability in the lithology. Some of the statistical methods we're using, we generated a 1 meter resolution elevation model from approximately 1,000 real-time kinematic GPS points in each of our watersheds. And primary and secondary topographic attributes were generated using GRASS-GIS. For the analysis of soil moisture, we're using multiple linear regression. And then for the analysis of soil properties, we're using something called redundancy analysis. And so this, I'll describe what that means a little bit later, but you can think of it as a multivariate extension to multiple linear regression. And the way we're accounting for nonlinear trends in soil properties with depth, we're using a technique called restricted cubic splines. And in cases where we're working with data that's described both in space and in depth, we've reorganized data collected by genetic horizon into regular depth slices. Very quickly, the two research sites. We have the Sierra Field Station. It's a metavolcanic terrain. You have these moderately deep soils, very strongly expressed argillic horizon, typically finding altic haplozeralphs or paleozeralphs. And then the Sierra Field, San Joaquin Experimental Range is on granodiorite, and these soils are approximately an order of magnitude less intense in terms of the relief. You see oak savanna here versus an oak woodland here, and the soils are much less well developed. Just a quick idea of what we're working with. The Sierra Field Station, the metavolcanic terrain, this is just a quick overview. We're working with this 30-hectare watershed. The red dots represent sites where we've sampled the soils and installed temperature and moisture probes. Temperature probes, we only had 22 of those. There were almost 500 moisture sensors. I'm only going to talk about data from about 135 of those stratified across the different gradients out here. This is the San Joaquin Experimental Range on the granitic terrain. Again, these red points are where we've sampled the landscape, or sampled the soils, installed temperature and moisture sensors. You can see it, the relief is much less intense. Okay, so now in terms of the results, very quickly, soil moisture data are very difficult to analyze and draw inference from. So what we've done is we've used an event-based approach here, where if we look at on the x-axis, we have the date. On the y-axis, we have the mean daily volumetric water content measured in percent. And from three different sites, south-facing backslope, north-facing backslope, and then a swale position, we want to look at two different characteristics of these moisture data. First, just the average water content. So I'm going to use this to describe the average water content. That's kind of the vertical offset here. And then also, we want to talk about the slope of the dry down. So that's going to be the change in volumetric water content. And primarily, we're interested in what degree of the variance in mean volumetric water content and the change in volumetric water content can be partitioned across some index of microclimate, some index of landscape position, the water holding capacity, because we know that affects the measured volumetric water content, and also a canopy influence. So we have physical differences that are fairly difficult to map, and then we have landscape differences. These are things we can try and key into with our DEM-derived products. And so moving to the granitic site, up at the top here, we can see the median soil, median volumetric water content stratified by depth. So at 10 centimeters, at 30 centimeters, and at 50 centimeters over the course approximately of a water cycle within this landscape. Again, this is volumetric water content. So what we're looking at here is the average volumetric water content by event. These are events here. So that's the offset within the event here. And what we can see, if we look at the partial variance explained, this is through multiple linear regression, over the course of this water year, the importance of solar radiation changes through time, and again, using this compound topographic index as a measurement of flow convergence and divergence, the importance of that changes through time. And clearly, these two metrics are more useful in describing differences in soil moisture near the surface than they are at the subsurface versus down deeper in the soil, where water holding capacity, as modeled by weighted mean particle diameter, suggests. So the point of this is that, yes, these DEM-derived metrics are telling us about patterns in soil moisture, but those patterns change through time, which isn't surprising, but they also have different interpretations with depth. Okay, looking at the dry down rate, so this is the change in volumetric water content. Again, solar radiation tends to be most important at the end of the cycle. The compound topographic index tends to be most important kind of at the middle of the solum, about 30 centimeters. Patterns changing through time. Very quickly, in this other landscape, the metavolcanic site, we see that partial variance explained in mean volumetric water content is mostly a function of the water holding capacity, the yellow, and the canopy influence. Very little is explained by these DEM-derived properties. If we look at the change in volumetric water content, that is the shape of these dry-down functions, well, in this case, it's a little bit more sensitive, or at least these relationships between solar radiation and profile curvature in this case are a little bit stronger. So what we can gather from these sites is that, well, the DEM-derived indices are useful, but they're not as useful as we might have thought they actually are. In this case, canopy and water holding capacity tend to be just about as important. Switching to soil properties, very quickly, I'm going to jump through what I just had there and go into something called partitioning variance using something called redundancy analysis. Essentially, it's multiple linear regression where you have multiple Ys, multiple Xs, and it gives you a framework for describing variance explained by groups of X variables. So in this case, we defined a terrain set of X variables, lithology, and depth. And that's partitioning variance in what we're calling soil character. So clay content, CEC, pH, carbon redness, and iron crystallinity. And we can see in the metavolcanic site that our suite of terrain variables here are actually explaining very little variance on their own. Most of the variance is explained by geochemical data we've collected by XRF or just via depth. So again, these circles here represent variance accounted for after partitioning out variance accounted for by the other groups. Where in the overlap here, this describes variance that overlaps between two or three of the groups. On the granitic site, much simpler landscapes, we see that the terrain accounts for, on its own, up to 24% of the variance. So you can think of that as an R squared of 0.24 is kind of what that means. And the lithology is only about 19%, and then about 18% in depth. So what this suggests is that why these granitic sites are a lot more predictable via these terrain indices than the metavolcanic sites, which is a little bit different than we hypothesized. These are much more, the relief is much more intense over here. So in summary, again, the interpretation of these commonly used digital proxies for soil forming factors or terrain indices, there's a lot of names for them. Well, soil moisture dynamics, which we're usually trying to key into with flow accumulation and microclimate, they're actually very difficult to predict with these surfaces. They tend to be most successful describing near surface moisture dynamics, and in this case in the granitic soils, the coarser textured soils. Interpretation of the terrain surfaces, well, it appears to be both temporally and regionally dependent, right, on these two different, very different rock types. We had very different relationships between the two. And, you know, obviously we all understand that there's a very complex feedback mechanism going on between soil properties in any given site, the local climate there that we're measuring with these sensors, and the vegetation there. So that's, it becomes kind of a chicken and egg question when you try to describe soil moisture as a function of terrain only and not really thinking about differences in soil properties. So also the prediction of properties from these commonly used digital surface indices and sites similar to our granitic landscape, well, looks like the best you can really do is about 28% of the variance in these suite of soil properties. And if you want to look at properties with depth, you can get up to about 46%. Well, maybe only 12%, or if you're looking through depth, 22%. So that kind of suggests that if we're going to apply digital soil mapping techniques in the Sierra Foothill region or regions like that, we might have to live with predictive capacities that are a little bit lower than we're used to seeing. And, you know, maybe that's the best that we can do. So presenting those along with some kind of confidence interval, even though it's kind of low, it might be better than what we do have. Final thoughts, this local variation in lithology can sometimes explain quite a bit more of the variance than terrain indices. These are very difficult to map, especially when you have vegetation. You know, it might be possible to coarsely map variation in lithology using gamma ray spectroscopy, but this is very expensive. And I'll go ahead and say thanks for everyone who's helped out with this and the funding sources. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. I can go back and talk more if that. Okay.